The war between Hamas and Israel is excruciating, seemingly unforgettable, but it's a good bet someone is already trying to memorialize this moment in music. Jeremy Eichler is the chief classical music critic for the Boston Globe. His new, deeply researched book, Time's Echo, tells of four composers, Strauss, Schoenberg, Britten, Shostakovich, writing during and after World War II. Jeremy also takes his own physical pilgrimage to see composers' writing desks, the gate where one of them hoped to free a relative from a concentration camp. Time's Echo was just shortlisted for Britten's top nonfiction book prize, the Bailey Gifford. And Jeremy Eichler joins us in the studio to take us through his musical journey. Jeremy, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And let's start with Richard Strauss, who in 1930 referred to Hitler as a criminal, an ignoramus. The Nazis then start rising to power. He felt maybe he'd be protected because of his fame.
Yeah, Strauss ended up with a kind of partnership of opportunity. He never joined the party, but he also failed to distance himself and stayed in Germany for the remainder of the war, allowing the Nazis essentially to use his music and his image to legitimate their own regime.
Tell us about the meaning of Strauss's Metamorphosen to you.
Yes, it is known to be a memorial only really because, first of all, the tone of kind of sincerity and confession in its music, but it has no words except for two words that Strauss writes into the score itself. He writes in memoriam on the very last line of the score, but he never specified what exactly it was a memorial to.
And now's where I should say, I'm not sure I'm going to make it through this segment. Because yes, you know, he thinks he's safe, but he sees his Jewish grandchildren brought into a town square and spat on. There's a story, we don't know if it's true. He presents himself at a concentration camp gate. I'm here to pick up my daughter-in-law's grandmother. And they laugh at him. These people that we see on pedestals, we realize how weak they were.
Yes, absolutely. They were each flawed figures grappling with the reality of these absolutely impossible times.
Someone you quote says, "These songs don't just fly to us over time, they come to us through time." So they're, of course, affected by time, and we hear them in a different way.
Absolutely. It's not just we who remember music, but music remembers us. Music preserves for the future these kinds of untranslatable truths from these earlier eras in time, and it can carry that meaning and that memory forward.
Yeah. Let's move to Arnold Schoenberg, one of the few who did recognize the threat of Hitler from the very beginning. He went into exile in the U.S., lived for a time in Los Angeles, and there we have that scene that you paint, you know, him sitting, you know, drinking Cokes and having hot fudge sundaes or watching The Lone Ranger and feeling himself so diminished and wanting to alert the Jewish community to the Nazi threat and organize some kind of response. The work that he wrote that you highlight, Survivor from Warsaw, begins with a single narrator telling the story of Jewish prisoners forced to assemble in a prison camp. Let's listen.
"I cannot remember everything. I must have been unconscious most of the time. I remember only the grandiose moment when they all started to sing as if prearranged. The old prayer they had neglected for so many years. The forgotten creed."
It then culminates in a chorus singing the central prayer of Judaism, Shema Israel. Come to something that you spent a lot of time on, whether or not we should even try to memorialize something as unthinkable as the Holocaust in music. It gives a sense of, okay, so there we did that.
Yes. The most famous comment in this regard was made by Theodor Adorno, who famously said that to write poetry after Auschwitz would be barbaric. But not many people realize that he actually came back to that subject in later years. And he said that because the world had outlived its own demise, it needed art as its unconscious chronicle. The Schoenberg that you're asking about, Robin, Adorno loved that piece because there was no facile sense of closure. There was no rest in peace. Let's just move on. But it really kind of kept alive the violence and the memory of these social contradictions that possibly led to war in the first place.
Okay, well, now entering the stage, Benjamin Britten, who wrote the exquisite War Requiem. This was to commemorate the rebuilding of the Coventry Cathedral. People might be able to picture this, the heavily damaged bomb by the Germans, Silhouette, its own memorial. And now comes Britten's musical memorial. Britten used the work of poet Wilfred Owen. Let's listen to a little of the final moments again in Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. This is the passage Liberame, music set to Owen's poem, Strange Meeting.
This is a particularly affecting poem that Owen writes, where he basically has two soldiers from opposite sides of the First World War meeting essentially in this kind of strange tunnel underground, and they realize that they're both dead and that they had in fact killed each other. And the futility of war having ended both of their lives for a reason that neither of them can really articulate.
Let us sleep.
Particularly Britten point of view, because he was anti-war, he was a pacifist, he was a gay man, and he was drawing from a poet from World War I.
Yes, I describe it, I think, as the great pacifist work of the 20th century.
Yeah. And of course, we have to talk about our fourth composer, Dmitri Shostakovich, who seems maybe the most wounded.
Yes, Shostakovich, in my view, was the great diarist of the great tragic utopian experiment in the Soviet Union that, as a body of work, really just holds a mirror to the broken hopes and dreams of that society and the kind of suffering that was endured by everyday citizens, who then in turn heard in his music some very profound truths about their own lives.
There's the massacre of Jews in the Soviet Union, then Ukraine, at Babi Yar. And then that was covered up?
Yes, and there were over 33,000 Jews lined up and shot into a ravine. After the war, Stalin wanted to kind of collectivize all of the Soviet losses. This meant erasing the memory of the Holocaust on Soviet soil. There was no memorial until 1961, when the poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko wrote Babi Yar. It begins with the line, "Over Babi Yar, there is no monument." Shostakovich immediately wanted to set it to music, and he did so as the opening of his 13th symphony.
What he did to have this music heard is really extraordinary, at such great danger to himself and to his family.
Yes, this was a particularly bold moment in Shostakovich's journey. You know, he at different points sort of seemed to crumble under the weight of the authority and the regime. But on this occasion, he stood up to the regime. I had the opportunity to interview his widow, and she recalled that day of the premiere, there was tremendous pressure to cancel it, but Shostakovich resisted.
The leaders tried to keep this music from getting to them. But they already had the memories. The reactions to these performances were explosive.
Yes, absolutely. You have these incredible accounts of these ovations that just went on and on and on. Shostakovich thought that perhaps before the Babi Yar Symphony, he took the hand of a friend and said, "If they spit on me, don't worry, I can handle it. Don't defend me." But of course, the opposite happened.
So bring us back to this idea of music as memory. It can't be stopped by government leaders.
One of my goals in writing the book was to spend some time thinking about what makes memorials in sound different from memorials in stone. You know, if you think about it, Robin, stone monuments can be toppled, books can be burned, they can all sort of succumb to the very forces of violence that they seek to memorialize. Whereas in the most positive sense, music remains untouchable.
Jeremy Eichler, again, the book is Time's Echo, The Second World War, The Holocaust, and the Music of Remembrance. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.